From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, filling in for Terry Gross. Today on Fresh Air, a Friday final Frasier Fest. But first, Friends. Could it be any more over? NBC's hit sitcom Friends ended last night. We'll have a review of the series finale and a look at the whole finale phenomenon. Then, as NBC's Frasier comes to a close next Thursday, we'll hear from Frasier Crane himself, Kelsey Grammer. Also, David Hyde Pierce, who plays Frasier's brother Niles. And Christopher Lloyd. No, not that one, the other one. He's an executive producer of Frasier. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Super Size Me, a documentary that follows a man as he eats nothing but McDonald's for a month. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld told members of Congress today that he's sorry for the abuse of Iraqi prisoners at the hands of U.S. troops.
We apologize. It happened, and that we did not have a system or a procedure where it would get pulled up and presented in a way that it could have been managed better.
Rumsfeld warned members of Congress that there could be worse news in store, unreleased pictures and videos of troops abusing Iraqi prisoners. The International Committee for the Red Cross says that Iraqi prisoners have been subjected to a number of serious violations of international humanitarian law. The highly classified report, which was leaked to the Wall Street Journal, says the ICRC had been regularly complaining about the abuses to U.S. officials for more than a year. NPR's Jackie Northam reports.
The ICRC report says some of the Iraqi prisoners were kept naked in dark, empty cells for prolonged periods. Others were hooded for up to 4 days at a time. Sometimes that hooding was done in conjunction with beatings. And the report details 8 incidents where coalition forces opened fire on unarmed prisoners, killing 7 detainees and wounding 20 others. Ian Piper, an ICRC spokesman, said these incidents go beyond just a few bad soldiers.
It is obviously more than that. It's too widespread and it's been too regular for it to be just classified as isolated incidents.
The ICRC says it gave this report to high-level administration and military officials in February this year. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Washington.
U.S. military officials in Iraq say U.S. troops killed at least 20 Iraqis today in gunfights between U.S. forces and militiamen loyal to Shiite Muslim cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Civilians were among the dead, including 3 young children. And the fighting took place around the southern Iraqi cities of Najaf and Karbala. In a sermon today, al-Sadr said his followers would drive out the U.S. Army, which he said was discredited by prisoner abuse. Oil prices briefly topped $40 a barrel this morning before easing back a bit. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
This was supposed to be the time of year when consumers would get a break from high oil prices. Instead, oil prices have kept on climbing. John Kingston, global director of oil for the Energy News Service Platts, warned there's not much relief in sight.
I don't really see anything that's going to end this. As you look forward, it's really difficult to see anything out there that would provide some significant downward pressure on the price.
Over time, high prices tend to encourage conservation, but U.S. demand for gasoline keeps increasing by the week, pushing gas prices to new record highs. Scott Horsley, NPR News.
The Dow lost 121 to close at 10,117. The Nasdaq was down 19 to 1918. This is NPR News. A CIA official said today that the latest audio tape purporting to come from Osama bin Laden probably is authentic. And the voice on the tape offers rewards in gold for the assassination of U.S. officials in Iraq, as well as top U.N. officials. The Department of Energy has ordered security reforms at the nation's nuclear weapons complex. Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham said that in the long run, the nuclear material stored around the country should be consolidated. NPR's David Kestenbaum reports.
Abraham said that while security was excellent, it needed to be even better. He pledged over the next 5 years to eliminate keys at the nuclear weapons facilities and replace them with things like biometric identification. He also promised that in 5 years' time, all computers used for classified work will no longer have disk drives, and that no single employee should ever be left alone with a drive containing classified data. Abraham also said that nuclear material at Sandia National Laboratory and Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory should eventually be moved, and he said the DOE would consider placing all guards under a single contract or making them federal employees. The nuclear weapons sites store hundreds of tons of weapons-grade uranium and plutonium. David Kestenbaum, NPR News, Washington.
A state board in Oklahoma is recommending clemency for a Mexican citizen who's scheduled to be executed later this month. Osvaldo Torres and 50 other Mexicans are awaiting execution in U.S. prisons. The World Court recently ruled that the rights of the Mexican inmates had been violated because they were not told that they were eligible to receive help from their governments under the terms of a 1963 treaty. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Right now on television, we're in the midst of finale fever. The NBC sitcom Friends ended its 10-year run last night, and another NBC sitcom, Frasier, closes its doors next Thursday after 11 years. In anticipation of the end of Frasier, we'll visit with Kelsey Grammer, who's been playing Frasier Crane for 20 years, David Hyde Pierce, who plays Frasier's brother Niles, and one of the show's writer-producers, Christopher Lloyd, who's not the same guy who played Reverend Jim on Taxi. But first, let's start by reviewing last night's final episode of Friends and looking at the whole phenomenon of TV finales in general.
So I guess this is it.
Yeah. I guess so.
This is harder than I thought it would be.
Yeah, it's gonna be okay.
Do you guys have to go to the new house right away, or do you have some time? We got some time. Okay, should we get some coffee?
Sure. Where?
That's from the end of Friends, as the six longtime buddies leave Chandler and Monica's apartment and their TV show behind. As that closing scene ended, and the friends helped Chandler negotiate his two-seater baby carriage down the hallway, the last image was of a dark and empty room photographed from within, echoing the final images of The Mary Tyler Moore Show and Cheers. But those sitcoms provided classy, classic endings. Friends just sort of stopped. It gave fans the ending they wanted, with Ross and Rachel reuniting, and tried to throw in some surprises and laughs along the way. But so much was predictable, and so little was exceptional, that Friends didn't so much go out with a bang as just quietly extinguish its own flame. Part of the blame here may go to the relentless media hype building up to the finale. A few months ago, there was a lot of buzz generated for the last episode of HBO's Sex and the City, which delivered no more surprising a happy ending. That finale, though, was much sharper and more satisfying. And a few years ago, NBC's Seinfeld closed its doors with just as big a tidal wave of advanced press hype. And arguably, it delivered with an excellent finale. I say arguably because some longtime fans hated that last episode, which ended with George and Jerry in prison arguing about the number and placement of buttons on a shirt. But that's precisely the way the first episode of what was then called the Seinfeld Chronicles began, with that same argument about buttons and shirts. The moral to that ending, and I think it was wonderful, was that in all those years, those characters had learned nothing and gone nowhere. I also loved the controversial last episode of Saint Elsewhere, which basically suggested that everything that had happened in that entire series was nothing more than the idle daydreaming of an autistic child. To many Saint Elsewhere fans, that was a betrayal. To me, it was a perfect metaphor for the imagination and ephemeral nature of television. The whole idea of giving intentional closure to a TV series can be traced to 1967, when The Fugitive ended its 4-year run by having David Janssen, as the fugitive, stop running. He found the one-armed man who murdered his wife and was cleared of the crime. Back then, this was such a big deal that the final episode became the most watched dramatic TV program in history up to that time. But what makes a final episode not only popular, but memorable? The group hug at the end of the Mary Tyler Moore Show? That was a classic. The message spelled out in Rocks at the end of MASH? That was another. But if there's one series ending in TV history that stands above all others as the most imaginative one ever, it's the end of Newhart. After 8 years playing Vermont innkeeper Dick Loudon and being married to Mary Franz Joanna, Bob Newhart ended that show by waking up in bed, in his old bed from the Bob Newhart Show, and waking up next to his old wife from that show, Emily, played once again by Suzanne Pleshette. The studio audience went nuts when the lights came on and Pleshette was there. What was even funnier, though, was Newhart's summary of what he called a dream and what we TV viewers recognized as the Newhart Show.
All right, Bob. What is it?
Well, I was an innkeeper in this crazy little town in Vermont.
I'm happy for you. Good night.
Nothing made sense in this place. I mean, the maid was an heiress. Her husband talked in alliteration. The handyman kept missing the point of things. And then there were these three woodsmen, but only one of them talked.
That settles it. No more Japanese food before you go to bed.
Situation comedies and endings don't get much funnier than that. Friends didn't come close, and Frasier may not either. But at least over most of its run, Frasier has delivered one of the wittier and more intelligent comedies on broadcast television. Kelsey Grammer first played the character of psychiatrist Frasier Crane on Cheers in 1984, 2 years after that sitcom had begun. When that show ended in 1993, NBC spun off the character into his own show, which has been running ever since. For a total of 20 years, Frasier Crane has been counseling other people while looking for true love himself. This season, in the person of Laura Linney as Charlotte, he may finally have found it and her. Here they are in a recent episode, snuggling in bed and talking about the future.
Charlotte, I'm afraid we're making a terrible mistake.
Frasier, I'm not switching sides again.
No. I mean, writing off these 3 weeks just because you're moving. I had a great time with you today. And with somebody else, it would have been a disaster.
With somebody else, I would have been in Portland.
Come on, you know what I'm talking about. We have a lot of fun together. Why deny ourselves the chance to have even more? I know the sensible thing would be to just end it now and walk away. And normally, that's what I would do, but I don't want to be sensible.
But we'd only have 3 weeks.
I know. It'd be like a summer fling.
But wouldn't we be sad when it ended?
Of course we would. That's what happens. You're sad when summer's over. Well, I never was. I mean, I always look forward to the new school year. I mean, I would buy my books a month ago.
Over the years, Frasier has won 5 consecutive Emmys as Outstanding Comedy Series. Grammer has won 3 Emmys for Lead Actor. He also moonlights occasionally on The Simpsons, providing the voice of Sideshow Bob. Grammer is proud to be drug-free right now and happy in his home life, but it wasn't always that way. When Terry spoke with Grammer in 1996, he had just published a memoir which dealt frankly with his history of drug abuse, minor scandals, and volatile relationships. She asked him how he created the character of Frasier through the sound of his voice.
Frasier has a voice that's filled with a certain amount of pretension.
Well, actually, that started, I got that from my years at Juilliard when I was taught by a woman named Edith Skinner, who helped to create the phonetic alphabet. She had a designation for the kind of accent I use, I guess. It was called Mid-Atlantic Speech, or Speech for the American Theater. And it's sort of a cross between American and British. There's the vowel R, which is the, you know, a final R sound in, like, father, mother, sister, brother. so you don't ever actually curl your tongue up for those words. And that in itself lends a kind of haughtiness to the language. And I suppose you could say Frasier is a bit haughty.
Were you hoping that your own TV show would be a show about Frasier, or did you want to start fresh with a new character?
Oh, well, it was my intention at first to go ahead and let Frasier die with Cheers. And the writer-producers of Frasier now, David Angel, David Lee, and Peter Casey, when I first approached them about doing the new show, we all agreed that Frasier should, you know, fade into the background and come up with a new character, a new idea. It was really very funny. They came up with a character that was sort of like a Malcolm Forbes type of guy who was pretty much had his fingers into everything in the country, but had had a motorcycle accident. So he was bedridden for a while. It was their intention, well, maybe three or four seasons down the road, to get him out of bed. But the initial idea would be that he would be surrounded by a group of people that were his support staff, basically, and this character would run the world from his bed. And
what'd you think of the idea?
Well, I thought there was potential, but then John Pike, the president of Paramount Television at the time, took me to dinner, and he said, "Kels, I was reading through this, and I just don't think a guy in a bed is funny."
And right.
I said, "You know, call me an idiot, but I think a sitcom should be funny." "Oh, well, John, it's very perceptive." So that killed that idea. We then spoke the following week, and John looked at me and he said, "All right, what about doing Frasier?" I said, "Well, you know, I kind of resist it." He said, "Well, I think there's great potential in it. I don't think the character is dead yet. I don't think he's been explored fully because he was always in the background before. I was responsible primarily for what I call hit-and-run comedy. I could get in, make my points, and get the hell out real quick. As the backbone of the show, Frasier did embrace the necessary qualities that made him a candidate for, you know, his own show. And so I agreed. There was some talk of it being a show with Lilith and Frasier, and I resisted that idea because I thought we'd pretty much played every note we could in terms of that relationship. You know, they were adversarial, they were fun to watch, but I didn't think they could really sustain what would hopefully be multiple seasons of a show. And so it became important, if Frasier was going to be the center of this new show, that everything else about it be new. And we took it from there and ended up with something I'm actually very proud of.
Do you think that there's anything about Frasier's personality that's rubbed off on you?
Well, you know, my imagination informs who Frasier is. I think I have enjoyed a kind of vicarious pleasure of exploring things that Frasier would that I really haven't bothered to explore because I had something else in mind.
Such as?
I enjoy the idea of sitting down with a good book and relaxing. And although I have done that in the past, I just don't do it anymore. It's not part of my life anymore. I mean, basically today I just read a bunch of scripts and most of them are awful. And I frankly don't have much time to read other than that. And I guess I miss that in a way. But Frasier is just this cohort of mine now that travels around with me. I certainly am recognized because of him, but he exists by virtue of the fact that I'm here, so it's a symbiotic thing.
Kelsey Grammer, star of the sitcom Frasier, speaking with Terry Gross in 1996. Coming up, Frasier's brother Niles. We'll hear Terry's interview with actor David Hyde Pierce. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
When David Hyde Pierce was cast opposite Kelsey Grammer as Fraser Crane's brother Niles, it was one of the best pieces of TV casting since Tony Randall was paired with Jack Klugman on The Odd Couple. Except this time, both of them are playing Felix. Niles is a psychiatrist like his older brother and is just as snooty when it comes to wine, opera, and other highbrow delights. The brothers Crane are snobbish, effete, egotistical, and insecure. They're also successful in different areas. Fraser is a local celebrity in Seattle, hosting a phone-in radio advice show, while Niles has found marital bliss with Daphne, their dad's former caregiver, played by Jane Leaves. Both Grammer and Pierce have won awards for their sibling roles. Grammer has won 3 for playing Fraser, and Pierce has won 3 for playing Niles. The last time Pierce won was in 1999. He talked with Terry Gross in 1998. Although the actors playing the Crane brothers compete in different Emmy categories, their characters ply their trade in the same field. Though they have a very close relationship, they also are very suspicious of one another and very competitive. Here's a clip from the show.
Hello, I know I'm a bit early. I was hoping we might get a bite to eat before the theater.
Actually, Niles,
it'll be on me, of course, as a thank you for getting those replacement tickets.
Just about the tickets.
I know, I owe you money, and my gratitude, and if I keep talking, you won't be able to tell me that you weren't able to get the tickets.
Just haven't been able to get them yet.
Oh, I knew you wouldn't get them!
Niles, please!
Oh, and now it's too late, it's 6 o'clock.
Please, just calm down. I've made a few well-placed calls. I haven't heard back from a couple of people. Someone will call.
Well, someone better call, because everyone who's anyone is seeing this play. And you know who you are if you're not anyone? You're no one. And I've been someone much too long to start being no one now.
The character of Fraser originated on the show Cheers. I asked David Hyde Pierce if when he was cast in the show Fraser, he studied episodes of Cheers to get a sense of the family traits and mannerisms.
Yes, in fact, that's specifically what I did. I watched a lot of old episodes of Cheers to get the physical behavior, because I felt like when I looked at my own family, first of all, I look more like Kelsey than I look like any other member of my real family. So physical resemblance isn't necessarily the key, but what does happen is people have the same kind of speech patterns and the same physical mannerisms. We've all had the experience of looking in the mirror and being horrified to realize we were acting exactly like our mom or our dad. And that kind of stuff, I thought, was what would let people know that we were really brothers. If we moved in the same way, if we had the same tilt of the head when we spoke, if we hit words and voiced words in a similar way.
I know Kelsey Grammer's a big admirer of Jack Benny, and you can kind of see that in some of his gestures. Did you go back to Jack Benny also to kind of better get to what Kelsey Grammer would be like and register that family trait?
I didn't. That's something else that Kelsey does, which was a whole new kind of acting for me, which is, I don't know if you know the term sampling, which they can do with pieces of sound technology. You can sample the playing of an instrument with a synthesizer. And Kelsey can almost sample famous actors, like someone who does impressions, except what he does is he will incorporate Jack Benny or Betty Davis or James Mason or whoever into the line that he's saying as Fraser, so that it is simultaneously echoes the famous person, but it's really still Fraser speaking. And that gives him this enormous range. I even did a scene where he did Daffy Duck in a perfectly believable way.
Fraser, in a way, the show is a contrast in two types of masculinity. You know, the father who's the retired cop and loves sports and his old easy chair and meat and potatoes. And Fraser and Niles, who, are impeccably dressed and they're connoisseurs of wine and food and furniture. And in a way, they're almost like, they almost embody certain of the traits that are stereotyped as gay traits. Including some of their gestures. And I'm wondering if that's something that's ever discussed on the set or the show.
We don't ever discuss it on the show, although we did address it, actually, in an early episode. There's a famous episode from the first season called The Matchmaker, where a new station manager took over Fraser's radio station, and the guy was gay, but Fraser didn't know it. And Fraser
tried.
That's
a very funny episode, yeah.
It was a great episode. Joe Keenan wrote it, one of our very good writers, and there was a whole mix-up where Fraser thought he was setting up this guy to date Daphne, and the guy thought it was a setup for him to date Fraser, And near the end of it, because of a variety of confusing circumstances, this guy also thinks that Fraser's dad is gay. And finally, it all gets straightened out at the end. And he says, so your dad's not gay? And he says, no, no, dad's not gay. And then the guy says, but Niles, come on. And it was our way of addressing, because a lot of people have talked about the fact, especially with Fraser and Niles and a lot of stuff that they do together, that, as you said, it's a sort of a stereotypical gay relationship, in that they like to dress well, they like fine wine and opera and all that stuff. But there's one critical part of gay relationships which they're not really into, and that seems to me to be the dividing line, and that's more of the anatomical area, which is they both love women. And so I think that the rest of it, as you said, it really is a stereotype if it necessitates them being gay because they like those things. There's a certain sort of, as you describe different kinds of masculinity, there's a very English, as opposed to English peasant, but a kind of an upper-class English feeling about them. Also a sort of Southern gentleman feeling, that it's a more of I guess you could say, a feline masculinity, as opposed to dad or bulldog, who's the sportscaster on the show, who's more of a, you know, eating hot dogs and beans and slapping people around kind of guy.
David Hyde Pierce plays Niles on the sitcom Frasier, which wraps up its 11-year run next Thursday evening. He spoke with Terry Gross in 1998. We'll hear more of their conversation in the second half of the show. Here's Sarah Vaughan from the Frasier CD. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Now, Frasier was an Asian lion living in a cage of iron in a circus out of Tijuana. Frasier was their big attraction, and he gave them satisfaction, doing it with talent and with honor. Yes, he was prowling for his daily dinner. Frasier kept on getting thinner with each measly can of Spam or tuna. Times were lean, but he was leaner. So one night in Pasadena, through the bars he split for South Laguna. Oh, cruel is fate, but it's never too late, said Frasier. I'm 91 and I haven't a son, thought Frasier. The blue-eyed truth is I'm ready for youth amnesia. All mad and tarry, a local safari rescue poor old Frasier. First they combed his tangled tresses, housed him with the lionesses, thinking him a harmless old grandpapa. Fed him niacin and fluoride, B12612 and chloride clams.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. By Barnes & Noble, now featuring My Soul Looks Back in Wonder, Voices of the Civil Rights Experience by Juan Williams, available at Barnes & Noble stores and at bn.com. And by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Villa Incognito, a novel about imposters, lovers, and strange Japanese animals. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more of our Frasier farewell. We'll continue our conversation with David Hyde Pierce. Also, Frasier executive producer Christopher Lloyd. Then, Big Mac Counterattack. Film critic David Edelstein reviews the new documentary, Supersize Me.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley. Let's get back to Terry's 1998 interview with David Hyde Pierce, who plays Niles, the brother of Frasier, on the sitcom Frasier. The show ends its 11-year run next Thursday.
Now, the writing is so funny on the show. Can you think of an example of lines that you particularly liked that kind of exemplify to you the quality of the writing?
Yes. The one that always pops into my head is there was a scene where the unseen Maris were having a party at Frasier's apartment, and no one can find her, and I explained that she fell asleep, and she's under all the coats on the bed. And my line is that she exhausts easily under the pressure to be interesting. And what I love about that line is, if you look at the actual wording of it, it's a little bit wordy, it's a little bit highfalutin, she exhausts easily under the... But what makes it funny is the description of this personality, because in some way we've all been there. We've all been at parties and had to put on that face, and we know how you go home and it's supposed to have been a party and you're wiped out from the effort. And she just takes it to the nth degree. So it's a combination of a skillful use of language, but also a skillful just depiction of character. And I think most of the humor of the show, as it should, comes out of situations like that, as opposed to jokes.
Because there's a kind of almost ornate style of speaking that Niles has, I'm sure his cadences are a little bit different than yours. Was it hard to get into that rhythm?
It's a good question. It wasn't difficult because it's well written. It's easy to pick up on the speech pattern. And again, because I was sort of modeling it after the way Kels speaks as Frasier, I had a role model there. One of the things that we are always playing with, and one of the differences between the writers who write for our show and sometimes when people send in scripts that they've written in hoping to get hired for the show, is that the writers understand that there's a subtle difference between someone who uses language in a certain way and just simply writing a lot of big words because that somehow seems to be what the characters are all about. A lot of times we'll find that you have to tone Niles' language down because in a given situation, a very emotional situation, say, or for example, he might not fall into those elevated speech patterns that he would have when he's more relaxed and he's talking about the wine club. And I think that's also what keeps him real.
Would you compare your voice and style of speaking with Niles?
Well, it's hard. You know why? Because as soon as I start getting analytical and talking about the show and being philosophical about it, then I automatically almost become him. There's a certain other placement in the voice that he speaks almost in a little higher pitch than I do. And the pronunciation of the words is just a little bit archer and a little bit more enunciated and, what's the word? That sort of thing. And there's little inflections like that creep in. Sometimes I'll be like somewhere else in the country and people will say, oh, you don't have an English accent. Thinking that I do have an English accent because of whatever it is I'm doing as the character, it reads that way.
It's arch and clipped.
Yeah. And a little bit operatic at times. He gets extremely agitated over not very important things. We just had he was just invited to a party where he brought a bottle of 81 Chateau Haute-Brionne, and he wasn't there 2 minutes before he heard a pop, looked up, and saw it being decanted into a punch bowl of sangria, canned fruit, and erotic ice cubes. So it is. It's sort of a higher range, I think, when he gets excited about it.
I know you shoot in front of a live audience, which means that there's real laughter that you have to deal with, which will affect the timing. You can't talk over the high point of a laugh. The trick is, I think, if the audience is laughing, and it's a fairly extended laugh, the camera doesn't pan to the audience. It's still on you. So you have to be doing something while you're not speaking during the laughter.
Yes. Well, we've all become masters of sort of idle fiddling and, stirring coffee during long laughs, or you can check your shoelaces and see if they're tied. What it is, it's just fun. It's you try to find behavior that the character would actually be doing in the moment But what you're also doing is you're feeding the laughter, because it just makes people laugh more when they see you riding that wave of laughter, however you choose to ride it out. If Kels and I are in the scene together, then we can do a good 10 minutes of just making faces at each other until eventually we both laugh and then it's over.
David Hyde Pierce talking with Terry Gross in 1998. Coming up, we hear from one of the executive producers of Frasier. This is Fresh Air. Christopher Lloyd, one of the executive producers of Frasier, has been with the show since the first episode. When he spoke with Terry in 2000, he had just written an introduction to a book of Frasier scripts. They began by discussing a scene that displays both the intelligence and humor of the series. Frasier's radio producer, Roz, is on vacation. Her substitute is an African-American woman. After Frasier encourages her to say a few words on the air occasionally, she ends up giving her own homespun advice on love and marriage to his callers. Frasier is afraid she's not only taking over his show, she's giving bad advice. But he's afraid to say anything to her. He comes home and explains his problem to his father and brother. They think he's afraid to confront her because she's black, and he's worried he'll sound like a racist.
For heaven's sake, Frasier, why don't you just talk to her?
Well, it's a delicate situation, Miles, for God's sakes. I mean, it's not all that easy. I mean, she is new to the field. She's sensitive. She's eager to please.
She's black.
Dad, please.
Well, you know damn well that's what this whole thing's about. I don't know what the big deal is. If she's talking too much, just tell her to shut her big bazoo.
Oh, really? And how do you suggest I accomplish that without sounding like a complete bigot?
Well, perhaps a little diplomacy is in order.
Oh, are you saying I should just choose my words more carefully? Is that it?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, fine, fine. All right, Niles. Just exactly how would that go? Why don't you play me and I'll be Mary?
All right, Mary.
Frasier.
I've been meaning to speak to you. You know, people listen to the show for my expertise.
Oh, so my opinion is not worth anything?
Well, I'm the one with the medical degree. Now, I want you to contribute, but only up to a point.
So you want me to stay in my place? Massa.
She's not going to say Massa.
What, am I getting too uppity for you? You sherry-swilling, opera-loving, Armani-wearing elitist? You have no idea how difficult it is for a black woman in a white man's world.
Frasier.
I don't think so. Look at me. This is ridiculous. I have walked myself straight into a minefield.
Christopher Lloyd, was this a difficult subject to take on? Dealing with race is so loaded.
It was. In fact, dealing with any politically oriented stories, we've stayed away from, for the most part, in 7 years. For whatever reason, it seems to sort of divide people or get people kind of agitated and so we have really not done any issue shows per se, but this is one that we were kind of intrigued by, just because these guys are so rarefied and so white, and I think a lot of people probably thought that this was in response to the kind of call for greater diversity on television, which it wasn't, although it kind of played into that a little bit, in the sense that it is such a touchy subject, and Frasier is sort of the perfect person to be made especially touchy by it. So we spent a long time, you know, wondering, is this really funny, or is this just kind of uncomfortable? Is it going to make viewers uncomfortable? But I think we walked the line pretty well with it, because it was true. It was a white guy saying, I have this African-American woman working for me. I don't like what she's doing, and I do not know how to tell her that without sounding like a bigot. And he struggled with that, and I think people laughed at it because it was a very real-seeming situation.
Can I take you back to the very beginning?
Sure.
Frasier. What was the very basic conception of the main characters, the father, Frasier, Niles?
I think the original idea was, all right, we have to find a way to make Frasier a little bit more human. All right, well, what about
compared to his character on Cheers?
Exactly. So let's explore his relationship with his father. Well, all right, we want some contrast here. So they decided, all right, I'm more of a blue-collar father. Let's give him a brother, too, somebody he can talk to. Well, the obvious way would be to make the brother blue-collar also so that there's conflict there, and Frasier's really the odd man out. What if we go the other way and make the brother a psychiatrist, too? In some ways, there was an echo of Lilith there, I think, two psychiatrists sort of nattering on in their way. So they tried that, and it worked tremendously well, in large part thanks to the casting of David Hyde Pierce, who's a great actor. After that, I mean, I think the story was that Frasier was looking for freedom in his life. He'd been kind of encumbered in his job and in his marriage in Boston, wanted to try something really new, started out in a new career, got himself this wonderful apartment, felt complete freedom. And the story of the pilot was to gradually take away that freedom, first with the father moving in, then the father bringing his chair, then the father bringing his dog, and then the father bringing his physical therapist. So those characters sort of fell into place.
Let me play a clip from the Frasier Valentine's Day episode. And this was the story of Frasier and his father going to the opera. And at the opera, they strike up a conversation with a woman Frasier's age who's at the opera with her mother. And Frasier wants to date the woman who's his age, but the problem is the older woman wants to date Frasier's father, and Frasier's father isn't interested. But Frasier has warned his father not to do anything that would alienate the mother because it would ruin Frasier's chances with the daughter. So here's Frasier's father and the older woman who's interested in him conversing at the opera.
Lovely production, isn't it? Mm. I adore Verdi.
Oh, he's my favorite.
Though the woman singing Gilda's a bit off. Mm,
she's no Renata Tibaldi.
You know, if you like Verdi so much, I happen to have a spare ticket to Aida next week.
Oh, that sounds great, but if it's a week from tonight, I'm busy, I'm sorry.
Actually, it's next Thursday.
Oh, Thursday? Oh, you know, there's this thing at my wine club.
Oh, that's all right, Martin. We just met. I shouldn't have asked.
Oh, no, Helen, it's got nothing to do with you. It's me. I'm afraid I've given you the wrong impression of myself. You see, the truth is, I'm...
gay.
Right. Gay.
I thought you might be. How many straight men remember Renata Tibaldi?
Not many.
Well, I'm sorry if I was too forward. It's just that sometimes it's so hard to meet nice men.
Tell me.
No, this is a very funny episode. Was this a kind of sensitive issue to deal with at all?
Yes and no. It's not entirely virgin territory for us. We did a show in the second season, for example, that also explored a similar theme called The Matchmaker, which had to do with Frasier thinking, well, Frasier on a date sort of with his the station manager who is gay. It's a
well, he doesn't think
thing,
it's a date. Let me explain what's happening. Frasier invites his boss over to dinner with the hopes of matching him up with Daphne, the live-in physical therapist. Frasier doesn't realize his boss is really gay, and his boss has interpreted the invitation as a kind of intimate overture, you know, like a date. You know, and he's expecting an intimate dinner with Frasier, and comedy ensues. It's a very funny episode.
Thank you. And written by the same gentleman who wrote the one that you're talking about, the opera show. His name is Joe Keenan. He's a fabulous writer. There was an article in a British newspaper a couple of weeks ago that described Frasier and Niles as heterosexual sissies. I think that comes pretty close to describing what we're after. And I have to say, I think we all kind of resist the stereotype, the idea that just because these guys like the finer things in life, the clothes and the wine, and are cultured, that suggests that they're gay. And sort of by extension, people have said Frasier seems to be written with a gay sensibility. Well, I'm not sure exactly what that means. We've always had gay writers on staff, but we've always had straight writers on staff too. And just because we like kind of more of a verbal orientation, you know, we use big words and the characters are witty, I'm not sure how that got translated into a gay sensibility exactly, but
I'm wondering if it's almost easier to write these kind of traits for straight men, because then you can't be accused of creating a stereotypical gay character.
I guess that's possible. I hadn't thought of it that way. I mean, Niles, neither one of them is gay. Neither one of the characters is. And there's you know, Niles is in love with his wife in the first four or five seasons of the show, and at the same time nursing a crush on Daphne. I mean, that, I think, sets him apart from a homosexual character right there. Frasier is constantly on the prowl for women. So I think it's a little unfair to say that they're, you know, they're gay in everything but, you know, the admission of it.
I think sometimes when a sitcom's been on for a long time, it gets broader and sillier as the writers seem to have exhausted some of the ideas that they started off with. And perhaps the best example of that was Seinfeld, which started off as this, you know, very kind of realistic show about trivial talk, you know, the whole thing about Seinfeld being about nothing. And then it just became more and more preposterous toward the end, more and more like a sitcom.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if that's an impulse that you've seen happen a lot and something that you have tried to resist.
Well, I think everyone tries to resist it. It's hard. You know, this week we're shooting our 165th episode. That's 9,000 pages of Frasier scripts. And so there aren't too many subjects that Frasier and Niles haven't talked about while sipping their lattes at the cafe. You have to really challenge yourself to not repeat things that you've done before, because people are very quick to say, wow, the show's getting stale, they've done that before. It is harder every year, and one of the things that you do is take the characters into new territories, obviously new relationships or new dynamics. We got Frasier fired last year, and people hated that, but it gave us sort of an arc and a whole new thing to explore with Frasier. But at least we weren't repeating ourselves.
There was an episode in which there's a new doctor who's joined the radio station, you know, doing a phone-in advice show. And one of the things he prides himself on is that, he sings. He loves to sing. Unfortunately, he sings really badly. And to get even with him, Frasier and Niles suggest that he sing at a party. And the song that he sings quite badly, although he doesn't realize how badly he sings, is Isn't It Romantic, which is it's a great song, and it's not a very well-known song. I thought it was interesting and kind of brave to sing a song that most people probably wouldn't know. And that strikes me as kind of typical of the program. A lot of the jokes and a lot of the situations, they're just very smart, and a lot of shows, I think, would worry, oh, is this going over the listeners' heads? How much do you have to worry about that?
We worry about it less and less. Early on, we would write a joke that used a real, you know, $10 vocabulary word or an obscure reference, and we'd say, gosh, aren't we clever and smart and wonderful, and we've amused ourselves with this, but the audience is never going to get this. We should really dumb this down. And really, Kelsey Grammer was one of the big champions of not doing that and saying the audience is smarter than anyone gives them credit for being. Don't dumb this audience. Don't dumb the material down. Don't write down to the audience. Keep that joke in. They will get it. And a joke that we referred to as a 10% joke, meaning we thought 10% of the audience would get it, would end up getting a big laugh. 60% of the audience would understand it. So we were, I think, a little bit maybe ashamed of that, but also encouraged by it and started writing those sorts of references and jokes more confidently. Just as a footnote, I appreciate your giving us credit for using having the courage to use Isn't It Romantic, but the reality of it is it's owned by Paramount. We didn't have to pay anything to use this song.
Oh, well.
But I accept the compliment.
Yeah, I thought it was so much more interesting than going with, say, I Got Rhythm or,
yeah,
you know.
We've had our share of strange references and musical pieces, but that was not one of them.
Christopher Lloyd, one of the executive producers and writers of Frasier. The final episode of Frasier will be broadcast next week.
Hey baby, I hear the blues are calling, toss salads and scrambled eggs. And maybe I seem a bit confused. Yeah, maybe, but I got you pegged. Ha!
what to do with those tossed salads and scrambled eggs. They're calling again. Scrambled eggs all over my face.
They're making me yah-yah. The salads and scrambled eggs.
They're calling again.
Coming up, the new documentary about a daily diet of McDonald's. This is Fresh Air. Morgan Spurlock's new documentary, Super Size Me, opens today in six cities and will go into wider release in the coming weeks. The talk of this year's Sundance Film Festival, it's the story of Spurlock's 30-day McDonald's diet. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Remember in A Clockwork Orange when they pry open the violent Alex's eyes and they give him a drug to induce nausea and make him watch violence and he never wants to do anything violent again? That's a bit like watching Morgan Spurlock's super entertaining, super disgusting, Super Size Me if you spend a lot of time in fast food restaurants, especially the ones with golden arches. Not too long ago, I was addicted to that stuff. Just the sense memory of a quarter pounder with cheese and large fries makes me gag. I know there's this idea that movie critics are lean, suave, athletic types, but after late screenings in Times Square, I was starting to hit the McDonald's pretty hard. I'd be chowing down under the harsh fluorescence with all the other pale and blobby people and feeling more and more disgusted with myself after every bite. For Super Size Me, Spurlock came up with a great stunt. It seemed to leap from the collective unconscious of our fast food nation. Spend a month eating nothing but McDonald's food. Three meals a day. And if they offer to supersize it, say yes. Here he is, pulling up to the drive-in window.
Hello, can I help you?
Yeah, could I get the double quarter pounder with cheese meal?
Large or super size?
I think I'm gonna have to go super size. Look at that. Look at that Coke. That barely fits in there. Look at that. Look at how big that thing is. Look how big that French fry is. That thing is like 4 feet tall. Double quarter pounder with cheese. More calories than anything. There it is. A little bit of heaven.
I gotta chime in. It's like the American dream to sit in your big car where you don't have to make eye contact with anyone and eat a supersized meal. You just inhale that stuff. It's the perfect delivery system for fat, sugar, salt, and carbs. Sure, it has nutrients, but not in proportion to calories. And it makes you feel bad, which Spurlock finds out as the scene goes on.
See, now's the time of the meal when you start getting the McStomach ache. You start getting the McTummy, you get the McGurgles in there, you get the McBrick, and you get the McStomach ache. Right now I got some McGas that's rocking.
Are you sweating there? My arms,
I feel like I got some McSweats going. My arms got the McTwitches going in here from all the sugar that's going in my body right now. I'm feeling a little McCrazy.
The punchline to that scene, by the way, is Spurlock puking out the car window, and the cameraman helpfully leans out to show you the vomit on the pavement. Spurlock consumed way too many calories for his 6-foot-2-inch frame, 5,000 a day. But no one, least of all the doctors who agreed to monitor him, expected the scale of what happened next. The gain of 25 pounds, the cholesterol leap of 65 points in a month. His liver fills up with fat. He's depressed and exhausted. His doctors regard him the way they would a man on the verge of a coronary. They tell him to get to a hospital at the first sign of chest pain. And it's handy because, as Spurlock shows us, there are some hospitals that have McDonald's right in them. We can choose to blame or not blame McDonald's and its ilk, but the statistics are hard to refute. That Americans eat out more than ever, that portion sizes have ballooned, that two-thirds of Americans are overweight, and half can be termed obese. Spurlock hits the road and visits elementary schools, where processed foods, soft drinks, and French fries are the rule rather than the exception. In the course of his absurd and manifestly self-destructive exercise, Spurlock interviews doctors, lawyers, nutritionists, an ex-surgeon general, his vegan chef girlfriend, who's revolted, and a food industry rep, everyone but McDonald's, which won't return his calls. The company has since announced the end of supersizing, and it issued a statement calling the documentary a supersized distortion of the quality, choice, and variety available at McDonald's. You mean those salads? The company goes on to say the film is not about McDonald's, but Spurlock's decision to act irresponsibly, a gimmick to make a film. Is it a gimmick? Sure. A great gimmick. Is Spurlock a hustler? Maybe. He once made a gross-out reality dare show for MTV. And I think he makes a mistake in the film, giving so much weight to lawyers suing McDonald's on behalf of obese people. That's an easy target for libertarians and the so-called free enterprise consumer groups largely supported by the food industry. Don't sue them. Just stop buying their food. I did, and cut carbs and started running, and lost 60 pounds last year. My dieting tip is to see Supersize Me. It will prop your eyes wide open and shock you into sanity.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Ian Chillog directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by HBO Films, presenting the DVD release of Elephant, written and directed by Gus Van Sant. It's a single ordinary day, except it's not. Available wherever DVDs and videos are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
May 17th marks the 50th anniversary of Brown v. Board of Education, the Supreme Court decision which struck down state-sponsored segregation in the schools. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about Brown's legacy with historian James Patterson and with Jack Greenberg, one of the lawyers who argued the case before the Supreme Court. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.